let's talk a little bit, as you settle down, about the extraordinary feeling that is abroad in our great city at the moment, Prime Minister.
It's incredible, isn't it? I wandered outside No. 10 Downing Street to say to a camera yesterday that it was becoming a golden summer for Britain. And literally, as I was speaking, we won another gold medal. So it is. There's a great cartoon on the front of the Telegraph of someone banging their television, saying it's broken. We haven't won a gold medal for 20 minutes. So there is this incredible sense of achievement right across British sport. And I think it's lifting the whole country, uniting the whole country. I've made a point in the last couple of weeks of going to Northern Ireland, Scotland, and yesterday Wales. And this feeling is very much not just a London feeling; it's a United Kingdom feeling, and it's a great time to be British.
It's a great time. Did you see the cartoon the day before where the horse is striking the Usain Bolt position?
Like
that was
yeah.
a very clever one, wasn't it?
No, I think it's.
I mean, this must have exceeded your wildest dreams, and even those of people like Lord Moynihan, I'm sorry, and others.
Well, to be fair to the British Olympic Association and to Andy Hunt, the leader of Team GB, they've always been confident, and I've always, you know, a lot of us just looking at the figures thought, hold on, we came fourth in Beijing, you know, can you really do better than that? When that's, you know, you've got to beat Germany, you've got to beat Russia, you've got to beat Australia. And they've outstripped their own expectations, but they were always confident. And I think they were confident because they knew that they had a really good system for backing our top sports people. I was talking to Ben Ainslie yesterday down in Weymouth, and you know, the support they've had over these last few years, they really appreciate. But look, I'm determined that we make sure this is not just a great Olympics for sport, but we really turn this into something for the country. And so I've been using the last 2 weeks, as well as visiting the whole of the United Kingdom, getting big businesses here, big investors here, governments from other countries here to say, look, come and invest in Britain, come and build in Britain, come and partner with us and take on the world. And we've done some big deals.
And have you set a figure? What's your goal of how many pounds worth of trade you want to get in, Prime Minister?
Total figure is 13 billion if you add up everything in terms of legacy, investment, trade deals, and the rest of it. But you know, one tangible thing for London, which I think Londoners will really appreciate, is you know, Battersea Power Station and the site round Battersea. You know, many, many acres on the Thames, a really prime site. We've now got the Malaysian investors going ahead with a massive refurbishment of that site, which will be good for business, good for homes, and also preserve the great iconic view.
Wasn't it, sir?
Well, no, the deal was actually signed and sealed, as it were, at one of our global investment conferences, and okay. The Malaysian investors were here. But there have been many other such deals, and I'm determined to keep that going. We had all the energy companies in town. We've got the big retailers coming, which I'll be speaking at tomorrow. So I'm shamelessly using this to promote Britain.
You talk about the legacy, and there could certainly be no better time than to try and build on that. But is it right you're speaking at the same time as, unfortunately, we've scrapped compulsory PE lessons in schools?
Well, look, we haven't done that. You know, sport is part of the national curriculum, and we want schools to deliver sport. And I think that's very important. But frankly, you know, and we're putting a lot of money in. There's £1 billion going into school sport over the next 4 years. But frankly, if the only problem was money, you'd solve this with money. The only problem isn't money. The problem has been too many schools not wanting to have competitive sport, some teachers not really wanting to join in and play their part. And so if we want to have a great sporting legacy for our children, and I do, I've got an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I want them to play competitive sport, and they want to play competitive sport, we've got to have an answer that brings the whole of society together to crack this. More competition, more competitiveness, more getting rid of the idea of all must win prizes and you can't have competitive sports day.
But surely they must do compulsory games, Prime
yes,
Minister.
Yes, absolutely.
But,
that's right.
But they don't have to anymore.
No, every school has to deliver sport as part of the national curriculum. It is there. What the last government did that I think, you know, isn't right is if you just simply sit there in Whitehall and set a target but don't actually do anything to help schools meet it, you're not really solving the problem. In fact, by just saying, look, I want you to do this many hours a week, some schools think, right, as soon as I've hit that minimum requirement, I've ticked the box and I can give up. And if you look at the very best schools in terms of state school sport in our country, there'll be ones who often say, don't set minimum targets, actually challenge us to achieve more and more and promote competitiveness. Now, one of the things we've done is that...
Prime Minister, what sport were you best at school?
I played quite a bit of cricket. And I still occasionally, I had played for my village the other day. And
did
I played
win?
A lot of tennis. No, we lost, actually. but if I think of my own, look, I had a very very privileged schooling and all the rest of it. But, you know, the reason why, aged 7, 8, 9, 10, I got into cricket and football and rugby was because I had teachers who, as well as teaching different subjects, gave up their time to go and coach sport and to coach children. And I think, you know, if you all those athletes we've been seeing, you know, when you ask them, what was it that helped you? A lot of them will say, well, I had a great geography teacher, but he also enthused in me a passion
but,
in
but
running.
But you went to a school, as did I, that benefited from having school playing fields, and not every school has playing fields, and indeed your government has continued selling off, in some instances, school playing
fields. Well, that is simply not true, and I've got the figures for you here. Right, there have been 21 playing fields that have been approved for disposal over the last 2 years, right? 14 of those were schools that had closed, right? So that's 14 out of the picture. Four of them were sites that became surplus when schools amalgamated. So that leaves three. So of those remaining three, one was surplus marginal grassland on the school site, and the proceeds of the sale are being put into better sports facilities.
Were you anticipating this question?
I was. I can explain, if you like, the other two, but both of them were actually about improving sport. So, look, it was a mistake that playing fields were sold in the past. They're not being sold anymore, but what we need is a combination of maintaining the playing fields, making sure the money's going in, asking schools to make sure that they all do their bit in terms of sport. But then we need a big cultural change, a cultural change in favour of competitive sports. That's what, you know, that's what I think what really matters. And one of the answers there is making sure the sports clubs really deliver in terms of sport in our schools. I think my own children go to a London state primary school, which does not have much in the way of playing fields because it's right in the middle of High Street, Kensington. They get a lot of their sport because we live in my constituency next to a village that's got a fantastic sports club. A tiny village, but they have 100 kids playing football every weekend. So back the clubs, get the clubs into the schools, link the schools with the clubs. That's how, because the clubs really believe in competition and the competitive ethos, and I think that's one of the best ways to deliver what we want.
Have you ever been a linesman to help out in one of the children's games, Prime Minister, or anything like that?
Sometimes help out a little bit on a Saturday morning with the children's football club, often I'm left in the clubhouse finishing the red box while my children run around.
Quite right too. Now, some questions of which you've had no notice. If you put on your headphones, we've been asking for some questions because people wanted to put certain issues to you, Prime Minister. If you indicate to me that you can hear all right, we're going to play you now a question. Anna from Finchley phoned earlier to put this to you, Mr. Cameron.
My question is, in view that no foreign aid is being cut, and I'm a cancer victim or patient waiting for treatment that's not on the National Health, and my local authority, health authority, is begging charities for my treatment. Now, I had my last chemotherapy in May, and it's a horrible feeling, waking every morning, waiting for £250,000, when they're giving billions away abroad. It's not fair. I need some funding now.
Now, that was Anna earlier. Obviously, this speaks to the foreign aid budget, which I understand is ring-fenced and is somewhere in the region north of £11 billion, Prime Minister.
Well, let's start, obviously, with Anne's case. And, you know, look, I think it's really important we get treatment to people who have cancer and who need it. And that's why we've done two things. First of all, we have not cut the NHS budget. We've increased it. That's very important. We're going to increase it throughout this Parliament. Secondly, we introduced the Cancer Drugs Fund so that people like Anne could get access to drugs when they were previously denied them. And I think around 10,000 people have benefited from that. And we're looking at whether we can extend that. So it's not just drugs that we're getting people, but also complex treatments as well. So I'm very committed to doing that.
Look, on the overseas, she's not getting her drugs, though, Prime Minister.
Well, I'm very happy to look into that case and see what it is that's holding
up. We'll
on the aid budget, I think, yes, we are having a difficult time in Britain, no doubt about it. But I think it's right, even as we have a difficult time, that we keep our promises to the poorest in the world, people living on, you know, a dollar a day or less.
But Prime Minister, there are people in this country who can't afford to heat their homes in the winter.
Well, I think that's why we're doing more to help people heat their homes. But one thing we've done over the last couple of years is invest in vaccines and immunisation for children in the poorest countries in the world. That act alone has probably saved the lives of about 3 million children.
But meanwhile, thousands of British citizens die each winter in the cold snap because they can't afford to turn up the gas.
Yeah, but as I say, and we are spending more on those programmes.
But imagine what that £11 billion could achieve, Prime Minister.
Well, of course, look, we could, as you say, we could abolish the overseas aid programme.
Well, why not start to take the same sort of prudent measure? Well, let's not use the word prudent. Yeah. The same sort of measures as you have in other budgets.
I would give you three good reasons. First of all, we made a promise as a country to meet pledges on aid, and we're keeping those promises. And I think breaking your promises to the poorest people in the world would not be the right thing to do. The second thing, as I say, I think we do have a moral obligation to help the poorest in the world, even when there are difficult times for us. And third, I would argue it's actually in our interest. What happens to these countries when they break down through poverty, war and disease? Mass migration, people turning up at our shores, wars that then involve us, the breakdown of these countries, if we can prevent that in the first place through our aid programme, we'll actually find it benefits us in a more national interest way as well. So I think it is the right thing to do.
Second, another question that came in earlier. Sam Silver is a former soldier. He served in Afghanistan. Let's give him the plug. He now runs a home removal company called Novam. This is a question he wanted to put to you, Mr Cameron.
With an estimated 45,000 soldiers leaving the military later this year, can the Prime Minister connect more with businesses in the UK to openly and proudly recruit ex-service personnel who have a wide range of transferable skills?
Yes, I think it's a very good question. This is exactly what we need to do. There will be people coming out of our armed services. They're extremely highly qualified. I think businesses would be mad not to whip them up because they've had such good training and such good discipline in their lives. And I think we can see that from the Olympics, where the armed forces are doing an absolutely magnificent job. But I absolutely agree we need to do more to help them into those jobs. We have plans, and I'll be saying more about that later in the year.
How would you characterise your relationship with Nick Clegg at this time, Prime Minister?
Look, we have a good relationship. We have a good working relationship. I think the government is delivering for the country. We're taking the tough and necessary decisions. We are leaders of two different parties. We often don't agree. We can't hide that. But, you know, frankly,
but what went wrong? Those sunny days in the Rose Garden. No, you seemed so
We were never going to agree about everything. But as far as I was concerned, you know, the British public didn't elect either of us outright winners at the election. So they were basically saying, can you get on, deliver good government and get on with the job? Now, there will be arguments. There will be disagreements. But frankly, the British public don't want to see that. They want to see us get on with delivering the changes we need to get our economy moving, get people into work, get business investing, and that is what I'm determined to do.
But he accuses you of breaking the coalition contract. How would you respond to that?
Well, look, there's a fundamental disagreement here in that I profoundly believe that the link was between the AV referendum that we promised to deliver and the boundary changes that I think are right, because you should have equal size seats across the country. Now, Nick takes a different view. He's entitled to do that. But as I say, this disagreement is not going to get in the way of getting on with what really matters, which is getting people back to work, getting our economy moving, getting investment in Britain. You know, and we have been talking throughout this week, having a series of meetings at the end of this week, to make sure that when it comes to investment in infrastructure, getting the housing market going, making sure people get work, the government is properly joined up and on the case.
And for my listeners who will hear today and possibly read in some of their newspapers your determination to try and drive through these boundary changes, why is it so important? You talk quite rightly about the economic perils that we face as a country. Why is this so important,
Prime Minister? It's very simple. If you take, you know, here in London, you've got a parliamentary seat like East Ham with about 90,000 people in, and yet in Wales there are some seats that have got about 60,000 people in. Now, there was a movement called the Chartists back in the 1840s who said that, you know, all constituencies should be the same size. So it's not exactly some radical novel idea that equal size seats are fair. You know, your vote should count the same wherever you live in the country. So equal size constituencies, I think, is a very fair thing to deliver. It's taken us a long time to do it, and that vote will come forward in the House of Commons, and I'll urge every MP to back it.
But how will you win without the support of your coalition partners?
Well, we've got a lot of water to flow under the bridge between now and then. But I think the case is extremely
strong. What on earth
can
that water achieve, Prime Minister?
Well, look, every MP is going to have to ask themselves, why am I voting against equal-sized constituencies and a smaller House of Commons? People listening to this programme would love us to cut the size of the House of Commons, stop spending so much money on politics, and have a fair system where all seats are the same size. That's what they can vote for when the boundary vote comes through. But be in no doubt, in spite of that disagreement, the coalition government will work and work hard to deliver the things that people really want and need in our country, particularly on the economy. And frankly, the House of Lords bill now going means that instead of wrangling about that for months in the House of Commons and the House of Lords, we can focus on the number one issue, which is the economy.
And you're quite right to say that, and you'll be aware, I imagine, the Bank of England are expected to say later today that they'll downgrade the growth forecast for this country.
Well, obviously, the growth forecasts, that's a matter for the Bank of England, but they've all been coming in line with the reality, which has frankly been disappointing. But the point I would make is...
What to be done, Prime Minister, then?
Well, look, I think what's happening is there's a rebalancing of the British economy taking place. We had the biggest banking bust anywhere in the world. We had the most indebted households. We had the most overblown financial system. And we had the biggest government deficit virtually in the world. So we're having to recover from those things. Now, if you take the last 2 years, there are actually 800,000 more private sector jobs today than there were in 2010.
That's still no growth.
Even when you take off the loss of public sector jobs, and some public sector jobs had to go because the public sector had got too big, there are still 500,000 more people in work today than there were 2 years ago. Our exports are growing. The sales we're making to China, India, Russia, the countries of the future, are up, you know, 60, 70, 80%. Our manufacturing sector, our aerospace sector are in good health. If you look at car, you know, we haven't been a net exporter of cars in this country since 1976, but we are again today, because Nissan, Honda, Jaguar, Land Rover, great brands are doing really well manufacturing here in Britain. So, yes, it's tough. Yes, the growth figures have been disappointing, but there's a rebalancing of the economy taking place, more enterprise, more small businesses, more start-up businesses that are going to be the engine of the future. And we just have to roll up our sleeves and work really hard to achieve this economic rebalancing that has to happen. The answer to debt can't be even more borrowing and even more debt. The answer to an overblown public sector and a private sector that's too small can't be just creating public sector jobs. We've got to get the motor of the economy, which is the private sector, small and medium-sized businesses. We've got to get those ones going. Right. And there's no shortcuts to that.
I'm afraid we've got time for about two more questions, so very, very quickly. You've talked about, indeed, before the game started, you urged London to people to be polite and to be patriotic. How important was the role of Mayor Boris Johnson in bringing about this feel-good factor in the city?
Oh, I think Boris has played an absolutely brilliant role as mayor. He did over his last term, and he is over this term as well. And I think London's very fortunate to have someone who's got this great ability to bring people together and to, frankly, cheer people up.
Could he be a good Prime Minister?
I think he's got a huge amount to offer the country. And I've always said that, you know, it's good to have mayors in our big cities, because I think our politics will be richer and our country will do better if you've got people going from national politics to local politics and people going from local politics to national politics. So I think Boris has got a huge role to play. He's going to be mayor of London. He's got his term to serve as mayor of London.
Why do people obss about your personal relationship?
There was an unfortunate
incident in school, was there?
No, he
stole your sweeties.
I've probably spoken to Boris, I think, every day during the Olympics. He comes to the Cobra meetings that I chair, and I'll be chairing one this morning, to deal with all the challenges and problems around the Olympics, which we've had to work through lots of things, and I think done that effectively. We work together extremely well, but as I say, I think he does a great job for London, and I'm sure there's more he can do.
He told me that he cried tears of patriotic joy at that extraordinary opening ceremony, almost a couple of weeks ago. Was there a tear in your eye, Prime Minister?
Yes, absolutely. Funny, if there was a tear, but both of us had the same reaction when Danny Boyle showed us his treatment for the opening ceremony almost 2 years ago. You know, I talked to Boris and said, you know, I feel this is going to be fantastic. There are one or two things that, you know, I'd love to see as well, but I think this is going to be fantastic. And he and I both had the same reaction. We both loved the James Bond, Her Majesty the Queen moment. There are lots of other things in there too that really did make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And it did. Funny enough, even when Danny showed me the drawings and some sort of video edits and some ideas, you could tell this was going to be, you know, a tearjerker. Excellent. And it was.
Are you at the closing ceremony?
I will be there.
Is there any great surprise? You're not hurling yourself out of a helicopter.
I'm sure there'll be lots of surprises. Look, I think whatever it was going to be, and I'm sure it was always going to be good, and I think there'll be a lot of music in it, the mood of the country is going to be... I think fantastic. Right. You know, I was there on the Saturday night when Jess Ennis won and when Mo Farah won and when we won that surprise long jump gold as well. And I don't think I could ever... in all the sport I might watch in the rest of my life, I don't think I'll ever see anything like that.
Well, a word on Sir Chris Hoy before I let you go. A phenomenal achievement, this man.
Well, the Velodrome has been it's been the pleasure dome, hasn't it? it's been absolutely extraordinary. Right. And the dedication of these people is something to behold. And as I say, it will inspire future generations. You know, my son has already said he wants to be called Elwin Wiggins rather than Elwin Cameron. And my daughter's been doing gymnastic flips around the kitchen floor to various...
Oh, she hasn't broken broken the sofa, because there are a lot of sofas being damaged, I think, as everybody tries to be a diver or whatever it might be.
I know, there's a lot of that going on. But the main thing is now to turn that into lasting legacy. We're doing that with the buildings and the park. We must do it with the sport and also with the business and the investment into Britain. And I'm determined we make the most of these successful
Prime Minister,
and well-organised games.
Last question. If you had to compete in the double sculls, who would you have as your rowing partner, Boris Johnson or Nick Clegg?
I think for weight, I think you'd probably, and strength, you'd probably have Boris. I mean, I've seen Boris on the rugby field, and it's
frightening.
Well, pretty impressive. Once he's heading in the... Also, we're in the building where, you know, the rumble in the lift took place. So, I know Boris is capable of...
he can get it done when he needs to.
Yeah.
Well, we'll try and give you a safe passage in the lift this time. Prime Minister, thank you so much for coming in, and enjoy the closing ceremony, and thank you for your time.